Good morning, everybody. This is Jim Mazzetti, and this is The American Dream. Thank you all for listening. Today's going to be another special day here when my actual guest arrives. He's running a little late. But I just going to remind everybody that's been listening and is hopefully just tuning in for the first time. This is this show is about The American Dream, and it's about entrepreneurs of Orange County specifically. Since there's so many of them, well, I kind of decided that it would be a I thought it might be a good idea to kind of spotlight an entrepreneur once a week and let them kind of tell their story on how they got there, why they did it, and what still makes them do it each and every day. And, you know, an entrepreneur, as you well know or don't know, if you're listening out there, listen, these are the people that have decided to kind of do it on their own, take the leap of faith, be their own boss. But being their own boss means doing everything, wearing many, many, many hats, as entrepreneurs know that are out there right now doing it. And it's not always a simple a walk in the park, but I'll tell you firsthand, there is no more greater reward than doing what you love each and every day. It's an amazing experience, without question. Challenging at times, to say the very least, but with, you know, there's no better reward. You control the destiny. And if you can conceive it, you can achieve it. Believe that very much each and every day, and I'm thankful to have the opportunity to do it each and every day. So if you're thinking about taking a plunge, folks, just remember, you know, it takes a lot of courage, I would say, for number one, and it takes a lot of planning, but you got to be willing to do both and do everything each and every day to make that dream happen. And remember, you know, these things, and you won't make money right away, without question, but, you know, it's not always about money. It's about the things you do for your community, what you do for your family, and ultimately, it's the control of your, hopefully, your own schedule, which if you're an entrepreneur running your own business, you know that's not really the case. But there's a lot of things out there, and it's worth doing. All right. Also, I just got to remind everybody that we are on every Tuesday from 10 to 11. And if there's anybody out there listening today that wants to call in and speak to our guests or speak to myself directly, please feel free at 845-651-1110. And getting a reminder, you know, this show is kind of sponsored by our firm, Miles Wealth Management, out of Florida, New York. And we are kind of a niche little firm, folks, that we work from individuals up to, but we love to work with small businesses, as you can tell. That's what we do each and every day. We love helping people get to where they want to go. And life is simple. You help people get where they want to go, you'll get where you want to go. One more little piece of, as I remember, last few weeks we've been going through here, is that Winslow Therapeutic, which is near and dear to our heart at Miles Wealth Management, is doing their honoree dinner this September 25th. Folks, this dinner obviously is to, you know, raise funds for, you know, a very good cause. These people do amazing work with the disabled and the mentally challenged in ways you can never imagine. So please keep them in your heart and in your mind. And hopefully, if you can find it in your way to donate not only your time, but maybe some dollars to keep that program going and going in Orange County, New York, please look them up at winslowtherapeutic.com, or I think it's .org. All right. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break here, and my guests will be sitting with us in just a minute. Folks, welcome back. This is Jim Mazzetti with The American Dream. And thank you for all for listening. We're on here every Tuesday from 10 to 11. And then, you know, as a reminder, we interview a entrepreneur of Orange County each and every week to kind of bring the spotlight onto what they did, how they got there, and why they do what they do each and every day. And my guest today is Luke Pontefell. Wait, did I pronounce that properly?
That's right.
Look
That's
at that. Right. And Luke is... I believe you're the owner of Thornwillow Press.
Correct.
Am I correct on that?
Yeah.
And I just kind of tee this up real quick, and then we'll kind of get into it right from there. But Luke, did you founded this company in 1985?
So I started, I guess I was 16 years old. I took a course in letterpress printing at a place called the Center for Book Arts in New York City, where you can take a course today, and printed a children's book that was written by a family friend for her grandchildren. And I sewed it on the kitchen table and carried it to bookstores and said, would you sell this book? And they said, no.
Challenge number one.
Exactly. And then found a few stores that said yes. Bless them. They've since gotten out of business. But found that what really started is this passion for beautiful typesetting, beautiful design, making books, making things. Started really when I was in school. My father was a writer in advertising, sort of from that 1950s and 60s advertising generation where he had a bar in his office, and I was the first tenant in the General Motors building. My mother was a sculptor and had her studio in Brooklyn and also in Massachusetts. Okay. And so they together restored this ancient, 18th century farmhouse and in Western Massachusetts, so 1780, growing up surrounded with furniture that they collected that had been around long before we were and is going to be there long after we're gone. So
Without question, restoring this house.
And so that idea of living with things, that idea of interacting with things that that were made to last, that were made to be beautiful, that were made to be part of your life and be passed on, is central to, I guess, what Thorn Willow has evolved into over these years.
Okay. Why don't you give us a little background, what Thorn Willow Press, I just gave it away there, I guess, Thorn Willow Press is about.
So Thorn Willow is a printer and publisher of handmade limited edition books. These books range widely in content from a book by Walter Cronkite on the first moon landing, a book with Arthur Schlesinger for the anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, a book with Helmut Kohl on German unification. Most recently, we did a book on FDR with facsimiles of letters and manuscripts and documents. These books, what's different about them is that they're hand-printed, they're on handmade paper, they're hand-sewn, they're objects that are beautiful.
They're art.
And they're meant to be works of art. They're also meant to be, in a way, time capsules. And so what I started when I was 16 was that, pursuit of the books. But what grew over time is a Thorn Willow Press, which not only prints and publishes these books, but then has collected around that core other related, artisanal crafts of the written word. For example, there's letterpress printing, engraving, we make business cards, we make wedding invitations, we make custom book bindings, boxes, all of these hand crafts that that have to do with the communication of ideas, the communication of the written word, which you might wonder, well, where's the relevance of that in the age of technology? Why do that?
When everybody can get it on their iPad, but it's not the same thing, is it?
Exactly. So I argue, and I feel that I'm in not alone in the universe, but I argue that as communications becomes increasingly disposable and intangible, you delete your correspondence. You turn books on and off with a switch. You store your memories in a cloud. People might walk away from this radio discussion, and it floats into the air, literally. In that kind of technological universe of communicating and preserving ideas, then making a book that lasts is actually really relevant and is a powerful way of communicating.
Without question, I think. I think you're spot on. I think there's still a lot to be said to actually holding something, looking at something, and appreciating how it got there. And, and like you said, in the cloud today, I think a lot of what's happening today, good or bad, is we're taking things a lot more for granted and don't understand, how it all got there.
I sometimes talk about objects having souls, right? And this is kind of wacky. People have souls. Objects don't have souls. Animals. My dog has a soul. She loves me, an unconditional love. But seriously, I think objects can have souls. And the way they get them is when you animate them, when you, human beings, animate them. That happens in a couple of ways. A craftsman who spends his whole life working every day at being better at that. This notion, Malcolm Gladwell in his book, you know, talks about 10,000 hours of working at something every day and trying to be better at it and better at it. And only then are you a beginner, you know.
Right.
Whether you're a taxi driver, a baker, or a bookbinder, it takes years of working at something.
To perfect your craft.
And in that, then it could be a coder, it could be a computer coder. I think coding is as much a craft as making a piece of furniture. But in that pursuit, you actually then breathe in your own identity. So for one of my favorite stories at the press is that these two guys who started now 8 years ago, Newburgh, where our press is located, as you know, has many, many social problems, and we can get to how we landed in Newburgh in the
first
place.
Yeah, we're going to get to that when we get back here after the next section.
But what is so interesting, so these two guys started, you know, one was working at Walmart, moving boxes around the shelf, the other, you know, was unemployed. They started by folding, and folding became sewing, and sewing became a cloth binding, and then a leather binding, and then gilding, which is the pinnacle of the bookbinder's art. And now, these two guys, after 8 years, which is now well more than 10,000 hours of doing this, are making books that are in the permanent collection of the White House and the Morgan Library and the British Museum. And long after we're all dead, these books will still be there. Their work will survive. And, you know, in my analogy of a soul, will carry the soul of that craftsmanship to, you know, readers yet unborn.
I think you're right. And I can feel it as I'm sitting here next to you, how passionate you are about this. Must have been some ride to get here, too. You didn't just end up in Newburgh, New York.
No, certainly not.
No.
And how, I sometimes break it into chapters. I started when I was so young. The first chapter was kind of growing this hobby in my dorm room at college. My poor roommate, I remember, was, you know, stepping over boxes and people coming to work in the dorm room, shipping books out. after taking that course, a family friend, William Shirer, who was the CBS correspondent in Berlin before the war, he joked. He said, "Oh, Luke, you should print something of mine." And I was 17. I said, "Oh, that would be great." And he gave me this monograph that he wrote on the dropping of the atom bomb. I set the type by hand, each letter one at a time, and did the same thing as with the children's book, hand-sewed it on the kitchen table, and brought that to bookstores. And that was more enthusiastically received.
Yeah, you sold a few more of those.
A few more of those. But still, the edition was, you know, 200 copies. And the joke is, with these early books, I was so excited to sell, you know, sell them out. I didn't even keep copies for myself.
Is that right?
It was crazy. what happened is every author became almost a mentor and a guide for the future project. So I took a copy of Bill's book and sent it to Arthur Schlesinger, knowing that it was the anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. And he sent a manuscript back in the mail. I never met him. I didn't know him. He said, why don't you print this? And I took those two books and I sent them to Walter Cronkite. And he didn't send the manuscript in the mail, but he said, come to my office and we'll talk about it. And I went to his office at Black Rock in New York City. And he said, okay, I'll do this.
Oh my God.
So it evolved, and by senior year, what was a hobby had become this little business. And I remember the last project that I did as an undergraduate was a book with Helmut Kohl. It was the wall had come down, but Germany had not yet unified. And he gave this speech, the Harvard commencement address, where he laid out very methodically exactly what he wanted to see happen in Germany and Europe. And then everything happened, sort of by like clockwork. The Germany unified, then the laying out the plans for the EU.
Like he wrote it.
Like he wrote it. It followed, you know, step by step. And so when the book finally came out, because it takes a long time to make these books, because each letter is handset.
You're not just getting it printed off at Staples.
You don't press print. But then he actually, you know, signed and dated each of the copies on the day of German unification.
Wow.
So in the sense of a time capsule, this is not, you know, a video clip that evaporates. It's not a memory, but it actually becomes a physical object that memorializes a moment in history.
That's amazing. Wow. You know, when I found out you were actually going to be our guest today, and I did a little research, and I'm like, I had no clue how this interview was going to go, and I still don't know how this interview is going to go, but I know I could sit here and just listen to you for hours about how you even came about doing this. Go back up here. You started this at age 16. And then, so you had four or five works done before you graduated Harvard.
Right.
And so after Harvard, was it a natural leap to go do your own business? Or did you go somewhere else after that?
What's funny is that at that point, it was a hobby still, but it started, you know, shockingly to make a little bit of money. So my parents, who, you know, were ready to sort of send me off into the universe and be done with me, actually were supportive, immensely supportive. And so they let me, I had my press in the garage in Massachusetts, and then was able to set up a little office in their dining room in the city and on summer breaks.
Yep.
From college was starting this little business and started employing people and paying salaries. And so that meant you had to have another book, because if you have to, you know, pay payroll, you need to have income, and that
you have to have
sort of
a pipeline flows. That comes in to make sure it's going to be there for next week and a month after and a month after that.
But it certainly was an organic process. It was not a planned startup with a business plan. We're going to, you know, go raise money from investors. It was one book
at
led
a time.
To the next. I guess the big then sort of shift to chapter two of Thorn Willow was I started doing to help make ends meet with the project, started doing design work. And so I was designing logos and typography, and started doing work for Mont Blanc, the pen company in Germany. They set up a foundation, which we designed the logo for, and was going back and forth to Hamburg, Germany, where they're based. And a friend had sent a letter on beautiful handmade paper that came from this mill in the Czech Republic, outside of Prague. And I was in Hamburg, and I thought I'd do a side trip and find this mill and see if I could buy paper from them. I just wanted to be a customer and buy paper. So got there, and it was the end of communism and the beginning of the privatization period. And it was one of these crazy stories. You know, you couldn't buy the paper, but you could buy the company.
Really?
and the communists did terrible things, obviously, in Eastern Europe. But one of the things that they did well was they preserved these ancient crafts, these artisanal crafts. In the Czech Republic, the paper making, the glass blowing, the ceramics, these crafts were somehow preserved. So Mont Blanc said, Luke, if you can set this company up to make paper for your books, but you can also make writing paper, we'll give you a contract for a year. And on that basis,
you made it happen.
Naively, you know, I said okay, and
it sounded like a good idea at the time.
It seemed like a good idea at the time, and started making the handmade paper for Mont Blanc, and that's basically how we started in the stationery side of our business.
Gotcha.
So the writing paper for Mont Blanc, but then it grew. We made the writing paper for Cartier, the handmade paper for Cranes, for William Arthur, for Ralph Lauren, Tiffany. And meanwhile, continuing always at the core with the books. But the joke is, it became the largest producer of handmade paper in the world. We had 50 employees dipping, and that's the term for making paper, dipping with these large screens, you know, sheets of paper. The joke, though, Jim, is that if you and I were to start making handmade paper here in this room, we would be the second largest producer of handmade paper in the world.
So there's not a lot of them out there.
Okay. And as the business evolved and grew, It was always about following craftsmen. It was about following the craftsmen to the ends of the earth, literally. Specialized craftsmen who were perpetuating and continuing these crafts of bookmaking and printing and typesetting. So ended up following a bookbinder in England who was retiring, and he helped me set up a little bindery in Northamptonshire, about an hour outside of London, to do the leather work for the books. And then an engraver who retired from the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, where he spent his whole career working on currency and postage stamps for the U.S. government. He was retiring in Pensacola, and he helped us set up another operation in Florida. And I remember blinking and realizing that I was running Thornwillow, this little business, as some multinational corporation with an office in New York, and spending my time splitting between Prague and England and Florida, and in each case following, though, these craftsmen, but also realizing that this was, you know, ultimately an untenable way of running
continuing.
A business.
Continuing.
Yeah. Yeah. And further, everything they say about doing business in Eastern Europe is true, or worse. My accountant, I remember saying, Luke, whatever you do, don't buy the building. I immediately bought the building. Whatever you do, don't put a new roof on the building. I put a new roof on the building. And when it was all had the ribbon, you know, with a bow tied on it, tragically under Czech law, a foreign owner has no rights.
No rights. No. That's right.
And so the manager of the company was able to set up another company owned by his 16-year-old daughter and somehow, you know, vaguely legally sell the work made in my factory to this other company and then sell it out on the market. So it became an absolutely impossible thing.
But what a lesson.
What a lesson and a catalyst for what I should have done on my own,
right.
which prompted then my wife, Savine, taking a compass out and putting it on the map and drawing a one-hour radius around our home and looking in New Jersey, in Connecticut, in Pennsylvania, and in Newburgh, that's how we found Newburgh, New York.
Okay.
An hour from New York, and initially attracted by the incredible architecture and the history.
Which Newburgh has.
Which is a remarkable city, and we'll yep. talk about this because it's in a change, I think.
I think we all hope so anyway.
Yeah.
But what an experience.
So we found this factory building, this complex of 19th century brick factory buildings, and have spent the last 10 years, this is chapter 3, of consolidating all of the operations under one roof. And so instead of following craftsmen to the ends of the world, the ends of the world, we're now becoming responsible for teaching and perpetuating these crafts ourselves, training, because you don't just hire somebody who knows how to be a bookbinder locally. You don't just hire someone who knows how to run this 100-year-old equipment. You have to teach it and you train it. And now, like the Bionic Man, it's better than it ever was before. We have, in Prague, we had 6 presses. Now we have 32 presses. We have projects start as an idea on one end of the building, the design, the typesetting, the engraving, and then move out onto the floor where we make the plates, and then the letterpress printing, the engraving, the bookbinding, the papermaking, and projects end on the other end of the building as a finished, completed project. So
goodness.
It's a dream. It's a dream come true.
It is. Well, hold that dream for a minute. Folks, we're going to take a quick break here. This is Jim Mazzetti with The American Dream. I'm here with Luke Pontefell from Thornwillow Press, with just having a very unique and different conversation about being an entrepreneur. We'll be right back.
Mike, I have good news and bad news. Good news is my son just got accepted to college.
Hey, congratulations, Bill. That's great news. What's the bad news?
We don't have enough money for his college education. I don't know how I'm going to tell him that we can't afford to pay all 4 years.
Listen, call the people at Miles Wealth Management. They helped me with my financial planning, and now I can afford my son's entire college tuition. To tell you the truth, for the first time in my life, I feel like I'm truly financially secure.
That's exactly what I need. Now, how do I get in touch with these guys?
You can call them at 845-651-3070, and their website is mileswealthmanagement.com. They're located right in the Village of Florida.
I'm calling them as we speak.
Miles Wealth Management, LLC is an independent SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Miles Wealth Management and its investment advisory services are offered independent of Signature Investors, Inc., and any subsidiaries or affiliates.
Hey, Dr. Phil here. Join me for Ask Dr. Phil. We're going to talk about what's important in your life. So listen up and start a change reaction in your life today. You're worth it.
Weekdays at 1:30.
Hi, this is Austin DuBois of Bluestein Shapiro, Rich and Barone. Tune in every Friday at 10 a.m. for It's the Law and learn what the law is. Ask questions, get answers right here on WTBQ, radio worth listening to.
WTBQ weather.
We have the chance of a scattered shower or a rumble of thunder up until early afternoon. But then it's going to dry out. We'll see temperatures about 80, and then a long stretch of dry weather, it looks like, right through early next week. Mostly sunny skies will develop tomorrow. After tonight's low, all the way down to 52, it'll be clear, heading up to the mid and upper 70s tomorrow. Clear tomorrow night with a few clouds down into the 50s, and Thursday mostly sunny and a high 75 to around 80. From the WTBQ Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Tony Salima.
WTBQ.
And we're back. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This is Jim Mazzetti with The American Dream. And reminder, we're here every Tuesday from 10 to 11, spotlighting entrepreneurs of Orange County. And today's is, this is uniquely different for me, Luke, I can tell you. I've had a bunch of different people on here, including my daughter, which we were just talking about off air real quick, who was millennial. And just a different world, and so neat, though, that because of this show, I get to meet so many different people and so many different entrepreneurs. And everybody's story is just that much different. But I got to tell you, yours takes the cake so far. So kind of jumping back into it, because I don't want to waste too much time. I'd like to, take back up with, you found Newburgh, New York by drawing a circle about a 1 hour radius around your home, which was very funny because my father did the same exact thing.
Oh, really?
And that's how we came to Warwick, New York.
Oh, that's also from New York City.
Yep. My parents are actually immigrants from Ireland. And then they immigrated to Canada, and Canada to the Bronx, like every other good Irish mm-hmm. family. And then from there, my father felt it was maybe a better way of growing up for my family up in Warwick, New York than downtown in the Bronx. So he did the same exact thing, and that's how we ended up here in Warwick, New York, because it was an hour commute.
Neat. Exactly. And so for 10 years, I would get on the train every morning early and ride at one of the most beautiful rides you can imagine. If you remember North by Northwest, the Hitchcock movie, they're forever going up on this train ride along the Hudson. It was the same ride. It was beautiful, and good weather, bad weather. It was wonderful, and I liked having that hour to myself, where yep. I could choose to answer the cell phone or not, and maybe sleep. And then at the end of it was a 5-minute ferry ride across Newburgh Bay that is breathtaking. The Hudson River School painters, that was their view. The seal of the state of New York is that view.
Is that right?
And you look from these cliffs at these bluffs at the heights of Newburgh out over Bannerman Island and over that bay. It's really one of the most beautiful places on earth. And you think about that city being such an important, historically important center of the country. George Washington lived there. He occupied that headquarters, the Washington's headquarters in Newburgh, longer than any other.
That's right. Because we know he slept around. He got around there.
He did. It's every bed and breakfast George
He's
Washington
been there.
Slept here. But there he actually stayed. He was there for a year and a half or more, and Martha Washington came and stayed there. And you have this incredible sort of foundation for the city. Then it's one of the first cities in the world to have electric power. Edison, one of Edison's first plants, maybe second plant in the country. this church, the Calvary Presbyterian Church on Grand sure. Street. First of all, has the Old Town Cemetery with all these incredible people buried there. They're forever. And then, but also Withers, the architect, built this church, and it's the first church or one of the very first churches in the world to be electrified. It has a pipe organ that was built by the man who built the organ at National Cathedral in Washington. And it was the model for the up and down the river of houses by Calvert Vaux, by Withers, the park designed by Olmsted and Vaux, who designed Central Park. You have these incredible mansions overlooking the Hudson. I Love Lucy premiered there.
Folks, this is Newburgh, New York. So this is not the Newburgh we're all been accustomed to
exactly.
thinking about. This is...
It was on the cover of Life magazine as the most most beautiful city to live in America. And then you have, in the 60s, this sort of social engineering gone wrong. And economic trouble. The factories along the rivers, river towns were all hit.
All failing, yeah.
But you also have this kind of concentration of problems. And so when coming out of jail, that's concentrate the problems there. People who need assisted living, concentrate the problems there. Instead of sharing it and spreading it across the county or across the state, you concentrate. And then with that comes an economy of poverty, the perpetuation of that problem and making it bigger because you have landlords who are happy not to maintain their buildings and not to improve them and get a high rent from subsidized
Section 8 housing.
You have government employees who exist to take care of a certain population, and they have their benefits and their salaries
sure.
covered. And then you have one kind of social good, what's set out to be a social good and to care and to be a safety net, ends up actually being a perpetuation of the problems that now has reached this extreme. Yet on the other hand, even with all of that, the city that was built to be for 90,000, 100,000 people and is now down to 30,000 people, and one doesn't realize how that shift. So you, even with this problem, the Newburgh that we know today, the beauty is there. You have these trees and you have these flowers that were planted and these bushes that were planted, 100 years ago and are incredible. Our house, we finally, after 10 years of commuting back and forth, I guess it was last year, we took our daughter, we have one child, we took our daughter to boarding schools to confirm her choice to stay at home with us.
To make a decision when she's going to stay or not go.
Yeah, exactly. And to confirm her choice to stay at home. And instead, she was captivated with boarding school, so she evacuated the nest. and with that, we didn't need to live around the corner from her old school. And we found this house that I'd been looking at for years and years, this wonderful stone house in the city of Newburgh, and suddenly a sign went up for sale, and we closed on that at the end of December, and in January moved in.
It was destiny.
It was destiny, and now seeing and living in a city that I was always just visiting, you see so much more,
and sure.
and I feel that it's changing as people were pushed from Chelsea to Soho to Brooklyn and then to Hoboken, and as the pressure for young artists, craftsmen, people who aren't in the traditional world of money making,
right.
have keep getting pushed further out. Yet now you start seeing that happening here in Newburgh, and you see people coming and opening interesting businesses,
yeah.
and the difference is that they're entrepreneurial. They're young people doing creative things, able to get fabulous space, able to get warehouse space, factory space, old buildings.
At a very reasonable cost.
Remarkably reasonable cost. I mean, you never imagine. The joke always is, you know, these houses would be the price of a studio apartment in New York City.
It's true.
You get a 10,000 square foot house. So, and in, you know, often in very good shape.
Yeah. So, like, please take it.
Yes, right. Please. Someone needs to. So it's a wonderful sort of combination of old-time America. Let's say it's a little bit Norman Rockwell in that you see the streets, the vestiges of that are there, combined with, though, the ghetto problems we've talked about, combined with young, artsy sort of Soho people. You have restaurants, you have interesting food, you have ethnic food, you have all these things kind of percolating, makes for a very neat place to live.
I was going to say, so as an entrepreneur, you're kind of having the foresight to see a renaissance of the area you decided to pick to put your business.
But when we landed there, when my wife drew that circle and pinpointed Newburgh, we were first attracted by the architecture, by the ability to get a lot of space. And with the business that we're in, we need a lot of space.
These presses are not small.
These presses are not small, and there's certainly a sickness that I have of collecting them. I mean, often these machines become anchors. So Scribner is the great publisher in the early part of the century that published F. Scott Fitzgerald and the amazing. Their presses, to a great extent, became moorings in marinas. So you drop the press down to the bottom, put a chain on it, float a buoy, and you can tie up a sailboat. So when these machines become available, I leap to collect them because there won't be any more made. Right. But I do have to hide this. My wife gets concerned when, you know, she sees a tractor trailer truck pulling up, a flatbed pulling up with another one.
Right.
But
so my wife and I show up on another motorcycle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So we have lots of space, and I think the idea was to have lots of space to expand the business, to grow if it grows, if the real estate circumstances change in Newburgh, we have a lot of it. But if not, it remains this fabulous place to run a business.
Sure.
That's convenient, close to New York, close to the hubs for distribution.
Right.
UPS gets things basically overnight to a very much larger circle because of where we're located. And that's all, you know, proves to be a very good place to run the business. And now training. And I guess we're ready now for chapter four. The last 10 years were about kind of reestablishing this foundation, collecting the presses, the buildings. One of the buildings across the street from us became available, and so we bought that. And it turned out, we had no idea, there was an underground tunnel that literally connected under the street the two buildings. And you should sort of chip through this little brick wall and expect to find, you know, people.
Right. Who's hiding down there?
Who's hiding down there? But there's this tunnel that connects the buildings. And so now it's been about renovating these buildings. It's about getting the equipment in, about training. And I can't emphasize that enough. This whole notion of teaching and training and perpetuating these crafts is central to what we do.
Well, you don't want to lose the art.
The art is the purpose.
Yeah.
The journey is the destination.
Very much so. Well, hold that thought for a second here, folks. Again, this is Jim Mazzetti. My great guest today is Luke Pontevel from Thornwellow Press, and we'll be right back.
Mike, I have good news and bad news. Good news is my son just got accepted to college.
Hey, congratulations, Bill. That's great news. What's the bad news?
We don't have enough money for his college education. I don't know how I'm going to tell him that we can't afford to pay all 4 years.
Listen, call the people at Miles Wealth Management. They helped me with my financial planning, and now I can afford my son's entire college tuition. To tell you the truth, for the first time in my life, I feel like I'm truly financially secure.
That's exactly what I need. Now, how do I get in touch with these guys?
You can call them at 845-651-3070, and their website is mileswealthmanagement.com. They're located right in the Village of Florida.
I'm calling them as we speak.
Miles Wealth Management, LLC is an independent SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Miles Wealth Management and its investment advisory services are offered independent of Signature Investors, Inc., and any subsidiaries or affiliates. That
jazz. This is Frank Lowell. Tune in every Sunday morning at 9 and Sunday night at 11 for And All That Jazz on WTBQ. You'll hear music of every style. It's the most eclectic show on radio. That
jazz. Hey, this is Joe Danz. Connect the dots in these challenging times with my Creativity and Technology for Business and Life show every Wednesday at 11 a.m. on WTBQ, AM 1110 and FM 93.5. Radio worth listening to. WTBQ.
Welcome back. This is Jim Mazzetti with The American Dream. And we are here every Tuesday on WTBQ from 10 to 11. And my outrageously interesting guest today, and we almost missed our cue because we were yapping so much off the air, is Luke Pontifel from Thornwillow Press. And we were talking before, in the segment before this, about kind of the history and obviously your passion for collecting all these old presses before they go the way of a buoy for a boat.
Exactly.
And creating this, recreating this craft, I should say, continuing this craft by training and hiring people and learning how to keep this wonderful craft going. But that brings us, that's old world that you successfully have preserved and are continuing on now. But how does that interact with new world today and marketing and commerce and so on and so forth? Because eventually, as much as we love what we do, we have to actually pay the bills.
Yeah, I think we talked about these chapters of Thornwillow. The
yep.
first being my, you know, starting this as a teenager, and then the operations around the world, and then consolidating in Newburgh. Now that that foundation is in place, it becomes about how to grow this business and how to
right.
expand this. And what is so central to the craft of making things is the object itself. But then there's the technology. We don't, you know, say, oh, we're reacting to technology. Technology's bad. Technology's evil. It's actually integral to what we do. And
absolutely.
A comparison is, you know, in 1800, there was a reaction to urbanization. In 1900, a reaction to industrialization. And I think in 2000, there's a reaction to technology, to things that are fast and efficient and fabulous. More has changed in the way we communicate in the last 10 years than has changed in the last 500 years. The Gutenberg Bible was letterpress printed, ink on the surface of the type pressed into the paper. That's basically the way the New York Times was printed until 1973. So
wow.
one doesn't realize how little change. The machines got bigger, they got faster, they got efficient, but it's still ink on paper.
Right.
Now, the technology of how we communicate dominates everything, whether it's our daughters on their cell phones,
right.
texting and communicating with the world, not just with the person sitting across from them, but with the world. So that's the reality, right? I've often compared a book to a violin. A violin is a wooden box that exists between the composer and the musician and the audience. And if well crafted, if well made, it becomes part. It's integral to that experience.
Very true.
A book is a physical object that exists between the author and the reader. And if beautifully designed, if beautifully made, enhances the relationship between the reader and the written word. The same can be
right.
said for a business card. That business card, if beautifully made, memorializes the moment of, you know, meeting someone. And hopefully, if beautifully made, beautifully designed, well-crafted, interesting, different, maybe you're not going to throw it out. I often say to the same young people that a letter, a handwritten note, it could be one sentence, a beautiful handwritten note saying thank you to someone who did you a favor, who's writing a letter of recommendation for you for school or for a job, is one of the most powerful ways of communicating. It's not an email that quickly says thanks or a text that says thanks, but it's something that someone receives, touches, holds, keeps. And that's an actually a very powerful and relevant thing today. Hermes, the great luxury brand, right? Maker of leather goods and pocketbooks and ties and scarves and all these things that we know today. Hermes was a saddle maker and a harness maker. And when the horse stopped being the commodity vehicle that got you from one place to the other, they became a brand about identity. And I would say the same is true today with our work. The letter, the invitation, the book is no longer the commodity vehicle for getting an idea from one place to the other. It becomes about identity. It becomes about how you think about yourself and how you would like other people to think about you, ideas that matter, ideas that you want to save, keep. But then in that context, you have to bridge the world of technology and right.
You can't ignore technology.
You have to embrace it and you know, co-opted into your mission,
whether you like it or not.
And we set up initially for many years. We've had a website, but one of my big missions has been to set up an online typesetting system, a portal where you can go in your pajamas at 2 a.m. and go to design a business card, an invitation. We've created these little, tiny, we call them identity cards. They're little, basically mini business cards. Room for your name, your email address, your cell phone. Because ultimately today, that's what you need.
It's
that little bit. And they're engraved, genuine engraving, heavy archival stock, and they come in little matchboxes. So you can put them in your pocket, and you open the matchbox, and you can give someone all the vital information they need. And it's you touch it, you feel it, you feel the engraving. Engraving is a process where the letter or the image is engraved into the surface of a copper plate or a steel die, and the ink is wiped into those crevices, and the surface is wiped clean. And then the paper is pressed into those crevices, and that results in a three-dimensional tactile object that has object quality. And it's something that's beautiful that you feel pressing print on your laser printer won't give that to you. You won't have this heavy paper. So it becomes about your identity. Here's my card. Let me give you my card. Here is a note. Let me give you this note. Sometimes a wedding invitation is the only physical object that remains to remember that day.
Right.
Maybe a few gifts.
In a video, maybe, that nobody watches for the next 20 years.
Yes, or so some relatives watch again and again.
Yes, just because there's always those funny moments that happen, right? But you're showing me that. So you've done work, and you still obviously continue to do work for the White House. Is that what you were talking about, that particular type of paper where it's pressed on there?
Yeah, so for years, I guess it started, I mentioned before how different authors then became sort of mentors for me. I had the honor of being able to work with Hugh Seide, who was the Time Magazine White House correspondent for years, for many, many administrations. He had a desk there. And it was a year out of college, got a letter about how do you choose your books? And would you ever consider doing something with Hugh Seide? And I said, absolutely, that would be amazing.
Why not?
Thank
sure.
you, that would be good. And ended up publishing a collection of his columns on the presidency. And in the process, would have these meetings at the White House. And it was before 9/11. It was before the security being the way it is today.
Yeah.
I remember the very first meeting with him and with the White House curator showing up at the gate at the White House, and you go through the security, and then you just walk up the driveway to the front door.
And then, just like that.
And an usher opens the door, lets you in, and we went into the went into the, I think it was the Red Room, and sat, and it was the afternoon, and we started with an iced tea, and then a little bit later, they served us some bourbon, and had our meeting, and continued. Over the years of then, the first chief of protocol that I worked with was Joseph Werner Reed, who started collecting the books for the White House collection, but also to give estate gifts, and at Blair House, and we did invitations, stationery. And so would go back regularly for these meetings. And at a certain point, you'd show up at the gate and they'd say, welcome back. Good to see you again. And probably on some system. And at one point, there was a meeting. There's the White House on the lower level is the White House Library, which originally was just sort of a little ante room in front of the men's room. And it was sort of a waiting area. But then at some point, it got turned into the library, and the president can choose books to be in there, and then others are permanently installed. And that's where the Thornwillow books are. But early on, I remember sitting in this meeting with Rex Scouten, who was the curator at that point. And the door opens, and in walks President Bush, Papa Bush, and the Air Force football team, all in uniform, lined up in a row, and he's giving them a tour because they had won the game. And
against Army.
As
usual, unfortunately.
And as part of the, you know, the trophy, I guess, a part of the prize was getting to meet the president and this tour. And so I remember, you know, standing up and being introduced to these Air Force football players as, you know, this printer and publisher of handmade books, and thinking, you know, God, and shook hands with every single one of them. And the funny thing is, you know, one of these guys started collecting our books.
Is
still
that right?
To this day, he writes letters. He said, you may not remember me, but we met in the White House. I said, of course I remember you.
There's a few things. How could you never forget that?
Exactly.
But you know, as we're talking here, you know, obviously we haven't talked a lot about business, but I'll tell you, this has been one of the most enjoyable interviews I've had, and outrageously interesting. But the thing that keeps popping up in me here is that this is a small little business in Newburgh, New York. But it's a true entrepreneurial story, and that's what's so great about this county, I think. And I think one of the reasons you picked it, besides its beauty and its architecture, is it breeds entrepreneurship and embraces it. And you certainly have taken it to the nth degree here, and you're still going. So what's next? Because we only have a few minutes, actually, two. What's next for Thornwillow?
Well, the now that this foundation is in place, we've embarked on the website, the online typesetting. We also recently paperwork was signed off by the state to create a Thornwillow Institute, so a nonprofit arm where we can teach and perpetuate these related crafts of the written word, and have a fellowship program, artists in residence who come and stay. So we're trying to renovate more of our real estate, more of our space, so that we can do that. So I guess there are these three legs. One is sort of the renovation of the space, the institute itself, and then the core business, which remains at the center of the books that we're publishing, and then the concentric circles of other printing around it, the invitations, announcements, other leather things that we do, and other products, and figuring out sort of new ways. We have the website. We also have our shops at the St. Regis in New York and in Washington, and where people can come and order things. But what I think is most interesting to me is this marriage of technology with craftsmanship.
Yep. Well, thank you, Luke. Thank you for all of listening. This is Jim Mazzetti, American Dream. And join us next week from 10 to 11. God bless and be prosperous.